Today, it's great to have Tal Ben-Shahar on the podcast. Tal is a best-selling author and leadership expert. He taught two of the largest classes in Harvard University's history. Today, he consults and lectures around the world to executives in multinational corporations, the general public, and at-risk populations. The topics he lectures on include leadership, happiness, education, innovation, ethics, self-esteem, resilience, goal setting, and mindfulness. His books have been translated into more than 25 languages. Tal is the founder of Happiness Studies Academy, an online program that provides the knowledge and the tools to generate happiness for individuals and school communities. Tal, so glad we could finally arrange this chat.
Yeah, so good to be here, Scott.
You're a really interesting cat, you know that? Looking into your background and everything.
Did my wife tell you to say that?
No, that's the opinion I formulated based on my research of your entire life. And, you know, I dug up some stuff, Tal. I dug up some stuff from your past. So this is interesting. Prior to pursuing teaching and psychology, you were on the professional squash circuit until you experienced a career-ending injury. Is that right?
That is correct. You know, Scott, I remember when I was 16, having the following thought. I thought to myself, what would I be doing when I can no longer play squash? It was not one of the central element in my life. And I resolved then to become a squash coach once I had retired. Unfortunately, I did have, when I was 21, almost 22, I did have a career-ending injury. And that led me on a very different path.
Oh, yeah. Or was it a very different path? You know, I read some of these really interesting books like Michael Murphy, you know, the founder of Esalen. He's written a book about golf, you know, and how it can lead to transcendent experiences. You know, I'm wondering, you know, in your squash days, did you experience inner happiness, you know, on the squash court? Maybe it's not as disconnected as we think.
Yeah, no, you know, you're right. You know, I often think about, I don't know if you remember the book, All I Needed to Learn, All I Needed to Know, yes. I Learned in Kindergarten. I often think that all I needed to learn or know, I learned on the squash court. So yeah, there are many parallels, and even, and they're not indirect links. So even my thinking about happiness today has a lot to do with my squash experience, in that I was actually generally not happy. I mean, I felt a sense of meaning and purpose, but I had a constant knot in my stomach, and I felt stressed, and I thought that winning tournaments, fulfilling, you know, reaching certain milestones, objectives would make me happy. Then I won a few tournaments and I was happy, but just for a very short period of time. And it was the first time when I thought about it. I mean, the thought wasn't formulated, but, you know, I realized that happiness is about much more than just reaching milestones, attaining goals. Then it was much more than about success.
Well, you know, you didn't go directly from squash player to Harvard. You also worked at a shipping company. Is that right as well?
Yeah, that is correct. That was my first job during college and after college. And the reason I got it was because the owner of the company was a squash player. And I think, I mean, I realized later on that he wanted a squash coach more than anything else. But, you know, got me to do some fascinating work and to stay in that. And I ended up staying in that company for quite a few years and learning a lot because, you know, I spent a lot of time on ships. And on ships, you know, you're sailing, there were cargo ships. So, you know, you're sailing with a group of, you know, 28, 30 men from 10 countries.
That's a lot of men. That's my first thought.
A lot of men, a lot of countries. It's a sort of a microcosm. And I learned so much about myself being on those on those ships, as well as about human nature and about different cultures. So it was really a formative experience on so many levels.
So how did you end up at Harvard? Teaching a course that ended up becoming one of the most popular courses at Harvard's in Harvard's history.
Yeah, so I was I think like most personal stories, there's an element of desire and planning, and then there is also an element of luck, fortune, and for me, given that I wasn't happy, I decided to switch my major, which was initially computer science.
At Harvard? So you were an undergrad at Harvard?
Philosophy and psychology.
Okay.
As an undergrad. And then when I went back as a graduate student, I had the real fortune of working with Professor Philip Stone, who had started working with Marty Seligman in creating the new positive psychology. So in 1999, Philip Stone was one of the keynote speakers at the very first positive psychology summit. And he took me along with him. So I attended that, and it was love at first sight. So then I was Professor Stone's teaching assistant for 6 years. More than that, he was my mentor. I was his apprentice for those 6 years. And when I graduated with my PhD, he was about to retire, and he asked me whether I wanted to take over his course.
Oh, he had.
Because he had been
teaching
positive psychology. And I thought for about, I think it was 3 or 4 milliseconds, I'm not sure. And I said, yes. And so I took over his class and started to, and I'm still teaching his class, following in his very big footsteps.
You teach it now with your Happiness Studies Academy,
yes,
is that right?
Yes, so I'm teaching it through the Happiness Studies Academy. Over the years, I've expanded beyond positive psychology, and today I integrate philosophy and economics and neuroscience and literature and film all into this field of happiness, because so many people had so many wise things to say about the good life. Not just positive psychologists and not just psychologists.
Yeah, I love that you take a really broad perspective. Do you ever find that the philosophy contradicts the science, and then you're like, what do I do? Does that ever happen to you?
Yes, actually often. And this is why I do love science. I come from computer science background. My first book that I read, other than Cliff Notes, Don't Tell My High School Teacher, was, when I was 23, because I was always into the sciences, and I'm still very much into the sciences, though I think the sciences and the humanities can and should inform each other. So when philosophers disagree, when there's a conflict between Aristotle and Confucius, two giants, it's science can be the arbiter.
Yeah. That's interesting. Science being the referee. That's kind of a funny thought. I don't know why it's funny, but it is. So this time period, what an amazing time that was for you at Harvard. I just want to zoom in on that time. The whole field of positive psychology was just emerging. There wasn't that much science yet on the science of happiness. There was Ed Diener's work, Life's Sad. I'm trying to think 1999, what was there in the psychological literature? You had to kind of be a MacGyver a bit of, do you know what I'm saying? And bringing together all these different perspectives into a coherent whole that inspired, these kids. I still talk to they're adults now, but those that were in your class, uniformly, they're all it changed my life. So you did something that right there.
Yeah, so a few things. First of all, No, I'm a big believer in Carl Rogers' claim that what is most personal is most general. So when I put together that class, I asked myself, what would I have wanted to learn when I was a student, you know, sitting in their seat? Because I struggled through college. And I knew when I was older that certain things would have helped me. So I integrated them into the class. So that's the first thing. Now, the second thing, you know, yeah, we are talking about, you know, 1999, early 2000s. Positive psychology is a new and emerging field. And at the same time, it's an old, in fact, ancient field. Because Aristotle talked about the good life and had so much to say about it. And then fast forward to the 20th century, you may have heard of a psychologist by the name of Abraham Maslow.
Yes, I think my audience has heard that name ad nauseum on this podcast.
And in fact, the textbook that I used for my my positive
Toward a Psychology of Being? Was it Toward a Psychology
of Being?
Oh my gosh.
Maslow wrote a chapter called Towards a Positive Psychology. Yeah. So he had a lot to say, still does have a lot to say about it. And in fact, you know, I thought about it recently. I think that there is an advantage in being at the onset or the beginning of a field when there isn't that much content, because
it's exciting.
it forces one to be creative, and it forces one to be eclectic. And there is a lot of value in eclecticism. There is a lot of value in the need to look outside your field. And you know, if a field has too many good answers, then there is no incentive to venture out. And I think venturing out is so important for, and again, whether you're in a new field or an old field, venturing out is so important, because that's when you become creative, innovative. It's just easier to do when you have no choice.
I think that's a really, really good point. Well, there was all sorts of interesting things there, you know, people who ended up becoming big shots. I want to just mention three people. So first of all, is it true Adam Grant was one of your all-time favorite students at Harvard? The organizational psychologist, the author of Give and Take and lots of other bestsellers. Yeah. What was he like as an undergraduate? Give us some gossip.
He was Adam Grant.
Wow. Mini Adam Grant.
He helped me a lot, I must say. Taught me a lot.
That is so cool.
So, you know, he was my student, and Leah Crumb.
That was the second one I was going to mention. Yeah. So Leah Crumb was your TA, one of your TAs, right? And now she is
initially my student, my advisee, and later became my TA.
And so just for our listeners, Leah Crumb is a professor now at Stanford University, doing really awesome work on the placebo effect and mindset, and how mindset can affect our stress and things of that nature. She's a superstar now. And then now also that you had Sean Aker was a TA of yours as well. Is it right? Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Sean was the head teaching fellow who masterfully managed the class. He also taught. He was already then an extraordinary teacher. And I must say it was So a bit of the history about the class. The first year I had just a handful of students, you know, 8 to be precise.
You only had 8 students your first year?
Yes, wow. But I'm actually not telling you the whole truth here, because 2 dropped out. So that leaves with 6.
I bet they're regretting it now. I bet those 2 are regretting it now.
Yeah, I hope so. they really hurt me. Then, you know, to lose, 25% of the class in one fell swoop, that wasn't easy. But you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
And it did. And it did. You're living proof of that.
And the the following year, it was the class grew, and I had, you know, a couple of hundred, and then the third year, much more than that, and it was like running a mini organization, and you know, with 20 teaching assistants, and you know, and so many students. I couldn't have done it obviously without Sean, without, you know, Jeff Perotti and so many other TAs who are teaching positive psychology today, and you know, we're still in touch, and it was a wonderful,
beautiful
experience.
Time in your life. I'm sure you feel very nostalgic when you think about that time period of your life. Well, I was wondering, and maybe this should have been my first question, but how do you define happiness? I think it's a really important question.
Yeah, it is an important question, and not an easy one, because there are so many definitions of happiness. And in fact, many people just say, well, happiness is like beauty. You know it when you see it, or you know it when you experience it.
Cop out. Answer.
But I do think it is important to define happiness. So I will not cop out of that one, because when we understand what it is, then we're more likely to find it. You know, it reminds me. Sorry, I'm not copping out. I'm just deviating.
I know.
Yeah,
we've talked before about this. you have a definition.
But Alice in Wonderland, you know, so when Alice meets the Cheshire Cat, one of my favorite parts, and she says to the Cheshire Cat, which way should I go? And he says, well, that depends where you want to get to. And she says, well, you know, it doesn't matter where I get to. And then you say, well, it doesn't matter which way you go. So if we, you know, if we want to get to happiness, we need to define it so that we know where we're going. So I see happiness as comprising five elements. They are the SPIRE elements. This is the acronym. The first element of happiness is spiritual well-being. Spiritual well-being is about having a sense of meaning and purpose. It's about being present, being mindful in the here and now. Physical well-being, the second element of SPIRE, is about nutrition, it's about exercise, it's about rest, sleep, recovery, it's about touch. Then there is intellectual well-being. Intellectual well-being is about curiosity. You know, this is one of my favorite all-time studies. Curious people actually live longer, all other things being equal.
Oh yeah, Todd Kashian's work a little bit shows that, right?
Todd Kashian's work, Carmelli's work. And, you know, I find that fascinating because, you know, they say curiosity kills the cat, but it actually helps humans live longer, which is nice.
It's one of the examples, yeah, that like the animal studies don't generalize to the human studies, you know, because with cats, it's no good.
They haven't done it on rats, though, so.
That's true. That's true. We should see. Hold out. But, yeah, you could definitely see, you know, cats, you know, need to curb their curiosity a bit. I could see dogs as well.
Yeah, so I hope cats don't read my book because it's dangerous for them, actually.
If they could read at all, that would be dangerous.
That's correct. Yeah. The Cheshire. And then you have, under intellectual well-being, you also have deep learning, which is also an important part of of intellectual well-being. And then you have relational well-being, the R of SPIRE. Relationships are the number one predictor of happiness, and it's relationships with others as well as relationship with oneself. And finally, it's emotional well-being. How do you deal with painful emotions? How do you cultivate pleasurable emotions? So it's spiritual well-being, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional. These are the five elements of happiness that make whole person well-being, or in a word, whole being.
Oh, I love that. I really love that phrase. Don't you have like a whole being institute or something?
So I was one of the co-founders of the Whole Being Institute, and now most of my work is being done as the Happiness Studies Academy, which focuses on whole being and the SPIRE.
I know about that. Yeah, I just associate that phrase whole being. I think, oh, tall, likes that phrase. I love that phrase because I've loved that phrase for a while when I saw you use it. That's great. So you said something about like deep learning, but where do you slot that into the spot? Where's the D? I'm confused about that one.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
No, deep learning is under intellectual
well-being. Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. And since you brought that up, let me just say a few things about that. Because, you know, when you say to people, oh, emotions, pleasurable emotions are important for happiness, you know, no-brainer. Mm-hmm. Or when you say a sense of meaning and purpose is important for happiness, yeah, of course, or physical exercise. But people ask me, how is deep learning connected to happiness? Well, it's connected in a very deep way, you know, going back to Aristotle, whom I consider the father of the happiness studies. You know, he talks about human beings being rational animals, and how contemplation is, in his mind, the most important pillar to happiness. But what is it about deep learning? You know, the first course that I took at Harvard wasn't actually in computer science, nor was it in psychology. The first course I took as an undergrad was in speed reading. This was during freshman week, and it was a very important course because you know, we were required to read hundreds of pages a week at times. So speed reading, important skill. However, looking back, I think an even more important course to teach, to mandate on college campuses is slow reading. So learning to look at, you know, one paragraph, a short text, read it and reread it and delve deeply into its meaning, its wonders. Why? First of all, because we potentially derive a great deal of joy when we deeply engage with texts or with nature or with a work of art. Second, it also benefits other areas in our lives. For example, relationships. You know, one of the reasons why we see so much relationship hopping in today's world, why we see the dissolution of so many relationships is because people no longer exercise the deep learning muscles. You know, the average amount of time that people spend on a web page is 7 seconds. So, you know, 7 seconds and new stimulation. And now we need new stimulation. And these muscles are exercised. And then we need new stimulation in life and we get bored very quickly. Instead, if we learn to delve deeper into a work of art or a text, if we really get to know a text deeply, well, then we can use these very same muscles, or they will be implemented automatically also when we engage and interact with a person. So, you know, the right neural pathways for deep relationships are cultivated. We develop them when we engage deeply with a text or anything else for that matter. And relationships is just one example. You know, I would apply it to, you know, the world of business as well. It can help us better know a person, ascertain whether a deal is a good deal or not. So the deep learning muscles are very important muscles, which in today's world, most people do not use sufficiently.
Yeah, I love that you include that in your model. Where does creativity fit into your model?
So, you know, when it comes to creativity, and again, who am I to talk to you about creativity? But when it comes to creativity, you know, we need to create the right conditions, put the right conditions in place. So, you know, the work of Alice Eisen and Barbara Fredrickson, you know, they point to the fact that when we increase or improve our mood, when we experience more positive, pleasurable emotions, we are more likely to think outside the box. So that's one element, you know, that would go under emotional well-being, increasing emotional well-being that will help us become more creative. But not only that, you know, intellectual well-being as well. You know, when we learn about different topics, we become more creative. You know, my personal favorite example. So, you know, so I love music, and specifically classical music, and specifically the classical and the romantic periods. Mm. So I listen to a lot of Mozart and Beethoven. If you listen to Beethoven's first two symphonies, they sound like Mozart. You listen to his third symphony, that's Beethoven. That's the romantic Beethoven. Now, Beethoven would not have become Beethoven without studying Gregorian chants and Bach and Mozart. So he deeply studied these, you know, so the illusion that, you know, the great creative genius, you know, brings creativity out of nowhere, it's an illusion. So deep learning contributes a great deal to creativity. And let me give another example from spiritual well-being. So part of spiritual well-being is being present, being in the here and now. Flow, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's concept of being in the here and now, that contributes a great deal to creativity. Mm-hmm. So if you look at, similarly, by the way, there's also research that, you know, having a good night's sleep, that contributes to creativity. So every one of the spire elements, including, by the way, relational well-being, which is the only one that I didn't mention. I mean, creativity often comes in conversation. And I remember, you know, you and I met for lunch in New York City. And I don't know about you, but my creative juices were flowing. And
I have very fond memories of that.
And, yes. and that was as a result, you know, bouncing ideas. You know, we talked about Maslow and we talked about, you know, our respective histories and our, you know, desired future. And these encounters lead to creativity. So every one of the spire elements is part of sort of the foundation or the ground, the fertile ground from which creativity grows.
Oh yeah, I absolutely love that. And my next question is more of a philosophical question because I'm really genuinely curious to know your thoughts on this. What's the benefit of putting all those things under the umbrella of happiness versus you slipped into the term well-being while you're discussing this. So do you equate happiness with well-being? And then what do you equate, like some positive psychologists equate happiness with life satisfaction and positive affect. And so that what do you equate with that? Like, what do you call that? What they're calling happiness, yeah, what do you call that?
This is exactly why it's so important to define our terms. And in that respect, it's I don't know if it's arbitrary the way we define our terms because, you know, there is rhyme or reason, at least to us. But at the same time, there isn't a right definition. Now, that doesn't mean there are no right and wrong and anything goes. You know, we know that doing certain things will have a positive impact and doing other things will have negative impact. But at the same time, whether you define happiness as comprising the five spire elements or happiness being about adding the each moment by moment experience and, you know, the aggregate of these moments is happiness, or whether you equate it with well-being or with life satisfaction, you know, that's a matter of choice. The reason why I chose to draw on the spire elements is because I think that is an inclusive and definition that brings together a lot of the works. You know, so Freud's work on the pleasure principle, Viktor Frankl's work on meaning, Robert Nozick or Daniel Kahneman's work on aggregating our, you know, experienced self, you know, at dinners, and Daniel Kahneman's work on, you know, looking back and reflecting on our lives. I'm including all those in my model. And yet, you know, there are people who say, well, you should add different things. You know, recently a few people actually said to me, you should include financial well-being under happiness because that's important too. And my response is that if it's important for you, include it. You know, as much as I emphasize research, I emphasize me search even more. And that is what Maslow emphasize a lot. So when he talked about doing research in psychology, he talked about a great deal about you know, digging deep, looking into our best experiences and learning from those, not just about looking at research that aggregates other people's experiences.
Cool. And it seems like you're really focusing on kind of the, is this fair to say happiness is kind of the emergence of though all operating in all cylinders and all those things? Because you, if you just pluck one of those things out of the context of the others, you get like, you know, you can get like a William James who was intellectual up the kazoo, but wanted to kill himself, you know, through most of his life. I wouldn't describe him as a happy person, you know? So it just seems like one of those plucked out of the context of the others is not necessarily happiness in itself, but it seems like you're using it. Is it fair to say that's more of an emergence of, you know,
yes,
filling all those boxes,
it is about, and because, you know, every one of those matter, you know, even, you know, you look at Viktor Frankl as a person who searched for and found meaning in his life. But to say that Viktor Frankl was happy when he was at Auschwitz, for example, you know, that would be ludicrous. So,
right.
You know, meaning is not happiness. At the same time, a person without a sense of meaning in life would be, you know, really stretched or probably impossible to find happiness. So meaning is a necessary but not sufficient condition for happiness. And you can say that about each one of the spire elements. Having said that, and this is often a misunderstanding that about the model, you don't need to have them all to the nth degree, or you don't need a 10 on each one of those elements. And in fact, you can't have a 10. And what you need is to ask yourself, so which are the ones that are more important for me? And let me go, you know, full steam ahead on those. And at the same time, manage the others so that they don't detract from happiness. You know, it has, I'll draw a parallel here to something that Peter Drucker, the considered the man who invented management, or at least modern management studies, you know, he said about strength, he said, we need to focus on our strength and manage our weaknesses. He didn't say focus on our strength and ignore our weaknesses. I mean, the same way, we need to manage all five elements of the spire and then primarily focus on those that are most near and dear to us. So, you know, if I think about it, you know, personally, intellectual well-being is extremely important to me, and therefore I spend a lot of time reading, you know, writing and learning. At the same time, you know, physical well-being, of course, is important to me. But you know, I no longer play professional squash, so I exercise and I do what I think is good enough in that area. You know, I'm not training for the Ironman. You know, I don't work out, you know, 3 hours a day, but I do what I know works for me, which is enough. So and we need to balance all these things, because you know there are only 24 hours a day, you know, 25 if we're going back from you know, changing the clocks, and we need to do the best that we can in the limited time that we have, and we cannot experience a 10 in each one of the spire elements. Just unrealistic.
I love that. I love that you mentioned, you know, you're hinting at the fact there are individual differences in desire to fulfill each one of those. Are there also cultural differences in how people, different cultures define happiness differently, right?
Yes. So, you know, when we look at and happiness, we need to look at it at three levels. The three levels are the universal, the cultural, and the personal. Mm-hmm. So the universal level, there are certain universals, you know, whether you are in, you know, in Nairobi or Sacramento or Shanghai, to be happy, you want a sense of meaning and purpose in life. You need to be physically active. You need to learn. Relationships are key in all these in every culture in the world, as you know, is gratitude and and dealing with painful emotions. So these, there are certain universals. At the same time, there are also cultural differences. You know, when it comes to relationships, again, in the US, much more individualistic. In Africa, the idea of Ubuntu, I am because you are, is a central concept. And in China, much more collectivistic. So there are cultural differences that we need to take into consideration, and certain things that will make a European or a North American, and again, I'm generalizing here, broad brushstrokes, that would make them happy would not necessarily work or not work in the same way in Africa or Asia. And again, very broad brushstrokes here. So there are cultural issues that we need to take into consideration. And finally, we need to take individual issues into consideration. And this is where MeSearch, because not all Americans or not all Kenyans or not all Chinese are alike. They're very different. And this is where we need to look inside and ask, for example, which one of the Spire elements is most important for me, and what can I do in my life to increase my the quota within that Spire element? Because for me, it could be, it's studying philosophy and psychology, perhaps. For someone else, it's studying languages. For someone else, it's art. So there are individual differences as well. And we need to look at those three levels. Again, the universal, the cultural, the individual.
Here. Thanks for that, making those distinctions. What would you say to someone, let's say a student came up to you and was like, Professor Ben Shahar, I really want to achieve happiness. What can I do to achieve happiness? You know, what would you say to that student?
I'd say to...
I want high performance on happiness.
I'd say to them, Houston, we have a problem. And,
that was my Scooby-Doo.
The reason is because of research that was conducted by Iris Moss. And what she and others showed was that people who start off by saying, you know, happiness is very important for me, or, you know, I'm going to pursue happiness and I'm going to be happier, they actually end up less happy. So the reason why we have a problem is because on the one hand, we're told this, but on the other hand, we also know that happiness is a good thing. You know, first of all, it feels good to feel good. Second, you know, people are happier, as we talked about, are more creative. They enjoy better relationships. They're physically healthier. They're nicer, kind. You know, we all want happiness. It's a good thing. And yet on the other hand, we know Iris Moss research, that waking up in the morning and saying that, or going to our professor and saying, you know, I want to be happier, and, you know, what can I do to become happier? That actually detracts, takes away from our happiness. So how do we reconcile this contradiction or paradox or challenge? And the way we do it is by pursuing happiness indirectly. So let me use an analogy before I give a concrete example. So the analogy is sunlight. You know, if the sun is shining and I'm looking up directly at the sun, that will hurt my eyes. That will actually cause me pain. So what can I do? I can break the sun rays, the sunlight, using a prism, for example, and then indirectly look at the sun. And then I can really enjoy the colors of the rainbow in the same way with happiness. Rather than pursuing it directly, I can indirectly pursue it. And what are the metaphorical colors of the rainbow? They are the Spire elements. So if I wake up in the morning and say, you know, I want to do work that's meaningful to me, or I want to be more present and meditate, that will contribute indirectly to my happiness. Or if I start exercising regularly, physical well-being, that's indirectly pursuing happiness. Or if I engage in deep learning, if I ask questions, curiosity, that's indirectly leading to happiness. Same for cultivating relationships, investing in my relationships, making them a priority, or expressing gratitude, emotional well-being. These are all ways of indirectly pursuing happiness. So enjoying sunlight without being hurt.
Oh, I love that. You know, a lot of what we talked about and even talk about that now, you know, it might be more of a privilege for some people over others, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, how can this positive psychology approach that you're putting forward try to lift up individuals who are most at risk populations?
Yeah. So a few things. You know, the first thing is the foundation of happiness is first allowing in unhappiness. In other words, you know, happiness is not about being happy all the time, or a happy life is not about experiencing a constant high all the time. In fact, it's about embracing painful emotions, accepting the fact that they're part and parcel of every life, difficulties, hardships. And paradoxically, when we accept and embrace painful emotions, that's when we open ourselves up to more happiness. So, you know, saying that or promising that, you know, if you truly understand happiness and do all the right things, so to speak, you'll experience a constant high. You know, that's a detached, unrealistic notion. Second, connected to this, it's not an all or nothing proposition. You know, people ask me today, you know, who know that I got into the field of happiness studies or positive psychology because I was unhappy. They say, okay, so 30 years hence, are you finally happy? And my answer to that is, I don't know. I don't even know how to answer this question. Why? Because I don't think there is a point before which one is unhappy, after which one is happy. I don't think happiness is not a binary 0-1. Rather, it exists on a continuum. And in other words, I'm happier today than I was 30 years ago, certainly. But I hope 10 years from now to be happier than I am today. You know, it's a lifelong journey, a journey that ends when life ends. Now, the point, therefore, is wherever I am on that continuum, the question is, how can I become a little bit happier? What can I do to increase my levels of well-being? And I can do that whether I'm on the depressed side, maybe perhaps the very depressed side on the continuum, or if I'm doing okay, or if I'm doing great and want to be even happier than that. In other words, the field is relevant for all of us. And the tools can be implemented for anyone, anywhere, anytime. The same time, the field, whether positive psychology or the science of happiness, is not a panacea. And it doesn't solve everything. And if a person is experiencing depression, then I recommend going to a conventional therapist or, if necessary, a psychiatrist. Mm. And if, you know, if we experience a serious poverty in certain areas, we need to alleviate the poverty and deal with the poverty. You know, going to... There are certain basic needs that are more important to deal with than happiness. Now, if you can deal with them concurrently together, then great. It's the best of both worlds. But if you had to choose, do I alleviate, you know, severe poverty, or do I teach them the science of happiness? That's a no-brainer, you know. Poverty first, of course.
Why do you think depression levels are skyrocketing? Do you think there's a relationship between technology and cell phone use and depression?
Unfortunately, there is. And this is based on a lot of research that's out there, whether it's Eric Kleinberg, who's a sociologist at NYU, who's shown that the more time we spend on social media, the lonelier we are. And then there is work by Jean Twenge from San Diego, who shows that the reason why levels of depression are so high among teenagers is because they're spending more and more time on the smartphone technology. You know, the number one addiction today, not alcohol, not drugs, not gambling, it's technology. And we're paying a high price for it. Now, in moderation, technology is great. But we've gone way, way beyond moderation.
Oh, yeah. I have this other screen up of my Twitter that I've just been on the whole time and keep paying attention. Oh, you said something. No, I'm joking. Yeah, I didn't do that. Okay. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, compassion is just over and over again in the literature a really important tenet of happiness. It just seems like social media, you know, just my perception, social media is causing us to be even more polarized and not talk to each other in those who we disagree with. We don't talk to them in such a compassionate way when we're performing, you know, trying to get likes, you know, and how do we get out of this rut and return to relationships and positive relationships and compassion?
No, that's the question. And, you know, the most troubling study that I came across, maybe my entire career, is by Sarah Conrad. And what she found was that levels of empathy among 20-year-olds today is, according to her measurement, 40% lower than empathy levels of 20-year-olds from 20 years ago. In other words, over a period of 20 years, empathy levels went down by 40%, according to this measure. Now, it doesn't matter how you measure, you know, they did something similar in the UK and they found that that teenagers and young adults displayed less empathy, less care, less compassion towards other people. Now, why do we see that? And the answer is, unfortunately, in technology, because how do you develop empathy? You know, empathy, as I see it, is the moral language and the language of morality. And how do you develop a language? Well, you know, take Vietnamese. Let's say, you know, Scott, you decide to study Vietnamese. One thing you can do is take classes in Vietnamese and, you know, three times a week, go to class and you'll learn and you'll memorize the vocabulary. And, you know, your Vietnamese will certainly improve. However, that's no match for going to Vietnam and immersing yourself in the language. That's when you'll really pick up the language. That's when you'll get to a much higher level than taking classes in Vietnamese. In other words, immersion, that's the key. Now let's go to the language of morality, which is empathy. What does it mean to immerse ourselves in that language? It means to be together in person with other people, to play in the same sandbox, to be around the same desk, to hurt someone and then see their reaction, to, you know, be hurt by someone, to cry, and then to reconcile. You know, that's how empathy is cultivated. It's not cultivated when you are on social media. Even worse things happen because you don't see the other person. You see that you get away with horrible things. And the natural, and it is natural, the natural sentiment of empathy is not cultivated, doesn't grow, doesn't develop. And yes, we can have more and more classes on, value clarification and empathy and talk about the golden rule. And that's important. I'm not belittling their value. However, that's no substitute for immersion in the language of empathy. And today, kids, as well as adults, interact far less face-to-face or in person.
That's a real shame. And it's COVID didn't help that, did it?
It didn't, and it's not. And hopefully it is temporary and we'll go back, way back to appreciating in-person interactions. At the same time, not all is lost on when we are forced to interact online. Because, you know, while perhaps we need to have more virtual relationships today by virtue of the situation. There is an important distinction that we need to make, and that is between superficial and deep relationships. You know, if I spend an hour with a friend through Skype, through Zoom, we can have a very deep conversation. And that deep conversation does contribute to developing empathy. Not the same as being in the same, you know, same room around the same table. However, it's a lot better than just interacting through emojis or LOLs or other shortcuts to emotions. There are no shortcuts to cultivating empathy.
Do you make a distinction between compassion and empathy?
Again, I think a lot of it is a matter of definition. I think they are intimately connected. So a person who cultivates empathy, the ability to identify other people's feeling and then to identify with their feelings, I think that person will be more compassionate, will be more caring.
Yeah. And it seems like care is kind of the underlying thread, you know, across all of that. You made an interesting point about more face-to-face interaction. I find that, you know, if there are people that are kind of, I find them to be kind of jerks on Twitter, if I DM them, you know, direct message them privately and talk to them, they tend to be quite cordial with me. And so it just makes me think that, gosh, maybe we should all be having more one-on-one interactions with each other than these performative self-esteem attempts at self-esteem boosts, you know. But
you know, if on Twitter or, you know, the talkbacks knew how much they were hurting the person that they were messaging, they would not do it. Mm. And not only would they not do it, it would go a long way into strengthening, you know, the empathic, the compassionate connections in their brains. But when it just goes out there, you know, into the ether, it hurts without them learning or even knowing just how much it hurts.
I love that. Well, so tell me about some, we'll end here with, you know, tell me about your latest endeavors, such as the Happiness Studies Academy. And then you have a certificate in Happiness Studies, CIHS. So tell our listeners about that, because they might be super interested in that, all that.
Yeah, so the Certificate in Happiness Studies is a year-long journey, which is actually a lifelong journey. But the year-long journey is where participants get a lot of, or you know, over 40 lectures and, you know, 50 webinars and a lot of reading and exercises. And the purpose of this Certificate in Happiness Studies is to help participants become happier and help them help others become happier. And we have students from over 60 countries who are, you know, therapists and coaches and consultants and managers and teachers and parents and, you know, and doctors, you know, the whole gamut. People who are introducing the signs of happiness to their professional life as well as to their personal life, helping themselves and others become happier.
That sounds great. That sounds really great. Well, I wish you all the great success with it. And yeah, thanks so much for chatting with me today. You're a legend in the field. So it was a true honor for me, you know. So thank you for the chat today.
Thank you for that, Scott. And I can't wait to meet in person again real soon.
I can't wait. All the best to you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience and would like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.